Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's the Autosport Podcast. We're joined by Corvette racing star Oliver Gavin to discuss the challenge of the Le Mans 24 Hours. With the Le Mans 24 Hours on the weekend of June the 15th, 16th, just around the corner, we're lucky enough to have one of the great race's most successful drivers of the 21st century to offer his insight by way of preview for the 2019 edition and also talk a little about his long career in the race. I'm your host, Ed Stewart, and our guest is Corvette Racing's Oliver Gavin. He has five victories to his name in GT machinery, set for his 19th Le Mans start. That's continuing a run that stretches all the way back to 2001. So presumably this is a race that just never gets old.
No, certainly doesn't. You know, it's always a great race with huge passion, huge atmosphere. I think every year the ACO managed to really build it up and make a fantastic event of it. And standing there on the grid each time, each year, the hair has been standing up the back of my neck, and you know, you get the goosebumps. And you think, yeah, this is a huge, huge sporting event and something I've been extremely lucky to be part of for, 18, 19 years now. So,
also joining me is Gary Watkins, who's our sports car expert, our expert witness, shall we say. And obviously you're a fixture at Le Mans, but the sight of Oliver Gavin in a yellow Corvette rumbling around the circuit has been almost as regular a feature as you have been, stretching all the way back to 2002, all but one of Oliver's Le Mans
That's
stars
right.
have been in the Corvettes, in the yellow Corvette.
And the amazing thing for me is that we're celebrating 20 years of Corvette racing at Le Mans this year.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary.
Which is just unprecedented for a sort of coherent manufacturer program. Sure, Porsche had a longer extended spell from the 50s until sort of the end of the 917 in 1971. But, yellow Corvettes going back year after year, you know, that kind of program is, we've never had before.
No, I think all of us go there each year, sort of pinching ourselves a little bit, going, wow, we're back again for another year. yeah, this is fantastic. And yeah, the you know, when you look at all the big programs that have happened, you know, whether it's stuff that Porsche's done or Audi or, you know, Toyota now, you know, you sort of think, wow, we're even longer than all those guys. That's pretty impressive.
Well, of course, what we forget, of course, is that Audi's sort of 2000 to 2016 was interrupted. Sorry, 17, no, 16. Sorry, can't remember. was interrupted by 2 years, which they happened to win, but they were represented by privateers. You yeah. know, people in the sort of people forgotten that, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, completely.
So yeah, it's just remarkable that year on, year out, we see two yellow Chevrolet Corvettes at Le Mans.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to sort of start there for them. You know, this would be my 18th time with them, it's you know, one of those races where, as a kid, you sort of thought, this is epic stuff. You know, we heroes racing around and driving in the great event, and you know, to be part of it and to be part of such a big American team that's, you know, has a lot of success there. You know, we've won 8 times and we're looking for number 9, and, you know.
Not a bad hit rate.
No. It's not a bad hit rate. I mean, there were some years where we were, you know, competing against some competition that, you know, let's say it was between us and Aston Martin for a number of seasons.
But how competitive were some of those races?
It was amazingly competitive those years. And I actually had dinner with Darren Turner last night.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And we were talking a little bit about that and reminiscing a little bit. And we've got some fantastic memories and some great races and some ones where, you know, it went our way, but also went their way. And I think it really sort of set the bar for GT racing there at Le Mans.
I think that's an interesting point, actually, yeah, in that it's continued from there into the sort of manufacturer era in what was originally GT2. And we've now, you know, over full-on, big money, highly professional, you know, highly professional manufacturer teams. Yeah, I think the trend was continued, and we're now in we're probably at the end of a glorious period, heading towards a slightly less glorious period with BMW and Ford going. But anyway, I think, you know, we've had an amazing period for the last, this decade, really, haven't we?
Yeah, I really think so. And, you know, the competition level has gone really through the roof, and year on year, people would ask me, you know, whether it was over in the States or back here in the UK, you know, what do you think your chances are, you know, after having a number of years of success, you know, through the sort of 2004, 5, 6, and even into sort of late, you know, 2010, 2011, we were knocking on the door and our teammates were winning. But then, you know, the GTE Pro sort of era came along, and you've got unbelievable talent from all of those manufacturers in terms of drivers, in terms of teams, in terms of machinery that they're bringing, cars, and, you know, it got, the bar just kept being raised year on year on year. And, you know, last year, was it 17 cars in our class? And I think you could have thrown a blanket over a good 14 of those, and any one of those cars could have won, really.
Well, apart from the car out front.
Yeah, there was that with that little safety car deal that they had. But, you know, that's sometimes the way it goes. And you know, I'm sure we're going to get onto this, but the race is so competitive and so fierce that one little thing turns it,
mm-hmm.
and there's no room for any error, and so the pressure on everyone is dialed all the way around to the max,
mm-hmm.
right from word go. As soon as you get there on the Sunday, you know, even at the test day, the pressure's being ramped up.
And with that, has it become more intense in terms of the lap times you need to do as a driver? Because historically, you think endurance racing, you can get away with being a bit kind of 8 tenths, 9 tenths. But now, particularly in GTE Pro, which has been ridiculous for the past few years, it just looks like a sprint race.
Yes, it is. And, you know, every stint is being examined, looked at. You know, all your averages are being sort of pored over by engineers and your teammates, yourself. You know, so that's in terms of lap time averages. And, you know, have you gained time? You know, have you won time to your competitors or have you lost time? You know, is that the right tire to be on? Do we need to switch to the other one? You know, do we need to change the car at all? You know, what adjustments can we make? You know, pressures, are they right? You know, we're going through every area to try and maximize what you've got. And you'll be going over data. You'll be looking at onboard if you can. You know, you're just... You know that every other manufacturer and every other driver and team are looking in every area to maximize their performance lap on lap on lap. So it really is almost like qualifying laps every lap. So you're just looking to steal a march on everybody all the time. And that's why it's so, it's fantastic to watch. It's great to be part of, but the pressure is, like I say, pretty extraordinary at times.
I suppose it's good to know that you can still hold your own in that environment. You're not the youngest driver. It's fair to say, but you're still in there, in the thick of it, able to perform at that level.
Yes, and you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm still there and I'm still competing with Corvette Racing. And you know, the stopwatch never lies. And so I'm backing myself, and the team are backing me. And you know, I'm there with fantastic teammates. You know, all with brilliant pedigrees, all with. I think there's some 19 victories now between all six of us that are in the team. And, you know, whether you're looking at the likes of Mike and Marcel who won the race outright or all the class victories that Tommy and Antonio and Jan have got, you know, it's a massive amount of experience and we all know how to win this race. So, yeah, it's, yeah, we try and pull all of that and put it all together and, try and come up with the best strategy and the best way forward. And you know, that's managed extremely well by all the big guys at Corvette.
I mean, we're talking about the old GT1 days. And I was talking to you on the phone several weeks ago. And you were talking about your favorite victory. And I asked you, and it was the completion of your 04, 05, 06 hat trick.
Yes.
I mean, was that because you got the hat trick? You kept the. Is there a trophy to keep for you?
Well, you're given a trophy. Each driver's given a trophy on the podium, but there's a trophy for the team and the car. So no, there's no trophy that you sort of keep for the year and then give back. Let's say,
There is for the overall.
Yeah, as there is for the overall. There's not that in the GT class, but you know, It was the fact that it was the same three drivers in the same number car 3 years in a row, and that was pretty special. And you know, I was obviously thrilled to be part of that team and still be part of the team and to share the car with those two guys. And you know, crew chief was the same across, you know, Ray Gongola was my crew chief for all three of those years. And yeah, so that was pretty special to be able to do that. And, you know, all three of the races were really quite different, you know. And so you sort of look back at those years and yes, very rose tinted spectacles, but it was extremely hard competing against the guys from ProDrive. You know, 04 was against the Ferrari, 05 and 06 was against the Aston. So yeah.
Interestingly, I was speaking to Tommy Milner about his favorite one, and he picks 15.
Right.
And again, I think that's a race in the sort of Corvette history that people point to because of the sort of the team spirit. Jan had crashed. He'd had the throttle stick in the Porsche curves.
Yeah.
Car was not capable of racing. Mm. So you're down to one car, and I think it's the way the whole team pulled together.
It is a remarkable story, and you know, certainly the atmosphere in the team, I've never seen it or sort of feel it sort of plummet to such depths as it did on that sort of evening there on the Wednesday at Le Mans that year in 2015. And you know, the sort of that realization sort of was sort of sweeping across people's faces, you know, that we were going to be down to one car and that, you know, this is a really big deal. And
that was because of Jan Magnussen's qualifying crash, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was down to the qualifying crash and
the throttle stuck.
Yeah, yes, it did.
And that was a big shunt, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, once we had established that Jan was okay and that you know, he was back in the garage, and then you know, we then started to look across at the data and seeing what had happened, and yeah, you sort of then start sort of trying to piece it all back together and trying to sort of go, okay, well, we've still got one car in this race, we've still got to press on here, we've still and the ability for all of the team to rally around and pick themselves up and go, look, we can still win this, mm-hmm. but obviously we've only got, as the Americans would say, you know, only got one bullet in the gun, mm-hmm. you know, and so you know, it was really that one shot. And I kind of know why another reason sort of why Tommy sort of picks it was because he drove so bloody well that race.
Oh, really? Right.
And he was so fast, and he just did an amazing job. I mean, he really was on fire that day, and you know, and Jordan as well. He stepped up, and it was sort of like I could see that the two of them. The two youngsters really came to that race, and they really sort of did come of age. That I feel that race, it was a real sort of turning point. I feel for both of them, yeah, because the pressure was massive as always, and you know you can't make mistakes. You've got to be on it, and you know the Ferrari was breathing down our neck, and then the Ferrari got in front of us. I think with a couple of hours to go, and. I was in the car to do the finish, and I was chasing, and we were gaining, but it was going to be tough and really tight. But then they had their problem with the gearbox, yeah. and we passed, and we were through. And then you're sort of into the realms of, okay, what are all those funny noises? You know, what are all those little things and feelings and strange things going on? And you try and you're calling on all the experience, and you're trying to sort of go, you know, no, there's nothing wrong, you know. This is all completely normal. This is all completely as it should be. Stop trying to make and create a problem. Keep off the radio. Just keep your head down and drive. And then it started raining, and little showers of rain out the back. And so you're on the radio to the team, and they're giving you the latest on the weather. And then I was driving around the track, and at certain points on the track, you can see the big screens. And I could see the screen as I was sort of driving by, and it's a picture of the garage of Tommy and Jordan and also my family standing there in the garage. And everybody looked terrified. You know, they all sort of looked, oh God, you know, just need this done now. You know, we just need, I think, because of the week we'd had, you know, it was sort of like, we just need to get this over the line. And then it's almost that sort of sense of relief. You know, there was a celebration in the garage, but I think it was almost a sense of relief to get over the line, you know, and get it done, and not something else disastrous happen and the rug get pulled from our feet, you know, once again. And
the other reason Tommy told me that he picked it is because he reckons you did the most amazing post-checkered flag burnout he's ever seen. And I actually did look in Autosport magazine from that issue. And I don't know if you've got that picture, but you should get that picture and have it on a wall somewhere.
I have got it.
He's absolutely right. It's fantastic.
I have got that picture. And actually, the story behind that was that I thought, okay, because this is the first year that the ACO had said at the driver's briefing, okay, after the checkered flag, we're going to do one full cool down lap. Mm-hmm. So we're going to, you know, take you all the way around the track again. And so as I'm on that cool down lap, I'm sort of thinking, oh, it'd be pretty cool to do a burnout right in front of the, mm-hmm. In front of our guys.
Because of course, Parc Fermé is then beyond.
That's just after the pits again. Yeah. So, I thought, right, well, I better just sort of practice this a bit, you know, so I can get it just about right. So I don't completely screw it up. And so I come down to Indianapolis and then through out of Arnage, and I've slowed right down and I've got it down into first gear, and I get the old revs up and I dump the clutch and I do this almighty burnout, but somehow I've dropped the car over the sort of crest in the road, right. And then the car starts having this massive fishtail, and then I nearly put it straight in the wall. And so... At this point, I'm thinking, what am I doing?
you know, come on, just get the thing back to the line. I need to get it done and back and not in a mess, you know, in the wall. So I then come back to the line, come over the line, and then I do the burnout, and I think I managed to do a pretty good job of it. So the boys were very, very happy. Yeah.
You know, one of your former co-drivers, Jan, has a bit of a history in the burnout department. I do believe it was at Portland in the ALMS when he won with Brabham.
Yeah.
He almost did a Bjorn Werdheim.
Oh, really?
And almost did it too early. Well, I think he did, and then realized he needed to accelerate to take the win.
Oh,
really? In ALMS times, yeah. So
that's the famous 3000 Monaco race you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, exactly.
Werdheim left it and Nick Kieser won, yeah.
All right.
Sorry, Bjorn, to bring this up.
All right.
I imagine he gets that a lot. But you mentioned that kind of feeling of, oh, is something going to go wrong? But of course, you have been on the wrong end of Le Mans, because it is a cruel race.
Mm-hmm.
2011 springs to mind when...
When
Jan Magnussen got caught up with the Porsche, didn't he?
Yeah.
On Sunday morning, you had that race in the bag. I mean, that must be so hard to take when you've done all the hard work almost.
Yeah, that was a particularly hard race. I sort of look back at that one in particular and I go, well, you know, the car for me was great. I loved it. I really enjoyed driving it. But I know Jan didn't. And it was the most... It's the biggest difference that I've seen in terms of what I was wanting from the car and what Jan was wanting from the car. And also talking, you know, through subsequent years, talking with them about their own car and our own car when we'd been on separate cars. And so it was strange how I really liked it and Jan didn't. But the incident that he had was completely out of the blue and just one of those things. You know, the sun's come up. You're thinking, okay, right, I think we were nearly two laps in the lead. We were in full control of everything. And he was trying to pass the Porsche, coming out the Porsche curves, and didn't see Jan. Jan gets on the grass, they collide, and then they both end up going off and into the wall. And I can just see Brian Hoy, my crew chief's face, and Gary Pratt's face, of this sort of disbelief. Of this, that can't be happening. You know, they're looking at the screen and the car is, you know, bouncing off the wall and it's smoking, it's stoved in the back, it's got numerous things missing, including the rear wing. And Jan's trying to get it back, but realizes that he can't.
He had a damn good go, though, if I remember.
Yeah, he did. He did have a damn good go.
But he came to rest sort of by the pit entry, so it wasn't as if it was that far away.
No,
was
he
it?
Was within
just,
sight.
Just yes, to make it even it? More
he was. He was, and I'm not. We wouldn't have been able to fix it though. I mean, it was. It needed to go back on the chassis plate and get straightened out. And I mean, it was done. And yeah, it was also a huge accident for the chap driving
Felbermayr.
Yes,
who was hospital. I think he did some ribs, didn't he?
I think that he did a bit more than that.
Yeah.
He was really quite badly hurt.
He was an old man, remember?
Yeah. But so, you know, he still had the license to race and compete. And you know, and this is an ongoing sort of story, really, with the race and with sports car racing, you know, that these gentlemen are in the race. They help keep the race going and they bring funding to it and they want to be part of it. But yeah, that did really completely smack us clean between the eyes and knock us all back down into our seats, and we were all sitting there really stunned for a long, long time. And it was a hard one to take. And Jan came back afterwards, and you know, he was distraught, you know, he was devastated for the team and for all of us, you know, and you know, we had quite a long chat about it, and you know, it's a really hard one to wear. But you realise that that's the race, that's the way it can be, and it can just completely bite you. You know, everybody has a story like that when they've competed there for this long.
Tom Christensen, 9 wins, but the 2 years he had the biggest lead of any of his times at Le Mans. Freak problems put him out. 4 laps, give or take, in 99 in the BMW.
Right.
And the throttle sticks open because the anti-roll bar brakes, drops down, a small part of the anti-roll bar broke, dropped down, and jammed the throttle in the Porsche curves on JJ Leto. 2007, the year before the great win for Christensen, McNish and Capello.
Oh, was that when the wheel
came wheel nut came off.
But it wasn't after a pit stop,
Well, it was after a pit stop, but they hadn't changed tyres. So it was 15 laps after a pit stop, after a wheel change.
It's bizarre,
and
isn't it?
And I actually asked Joerst, well, Ralf Jüttner, the boss of Joerst, about if they ever found out what happened. And they go, well, we might have done if we'd have found the wheel nut, but it probably bounced and bounced for a kilometre or so into the woods,
yeah,
so
the
we'll
woods
never
somewhere.
Find it.
Yeah.
But that, I think that shows you, isn't it, that Le Mans is everyone has a hard luck story,
of course.
Tom Christensen.
Yeah, and, you know, and he has done an amazing job and has just been a phenomenal race car driver there at that race. You know, he's had such an amazing performance. Mm-hmm.
The other story I like about Corvette racing and its will to win is 2004, when obviously you won the race with Jan and Olivier Biretta, but the other car got involved in quite a few dings and dongs.
Oh, we all did, I think.
Well, I think you did as well,
Yeah, I did.
And
I know Jan did. And there was a point in that race where the team were on the radio saying, look, we have no more spares. Do not go off the road again. Do not hit anything. Do not touch anything. We're done. You know, you damage the car anymore, you know, we can't continue. And at the back of our garage, there was this huge pile of bodywork. It was like a mountain of bodywork. And in the end, we finished the race with there was a show car. There was a show car.
This is my story. Tell it better than me.
Sorry. But there was after all the numerous incidents and accidents, I think Jan had an incident with Jamie Davies in the Audi, the champion. I think it was Velox Audi. Yeah. And then I'd had a run-in with someone going through the first chicane just after they'd fixed it, I think, from Jan's incident. I'd taken it through the gravel at the first chicane. And there was numerous other things that had happened. And then it came to a sort of the last few hours and there was something else that went wrong. And in the end, they went down to the show car that was
Which was in the village.
Yes.
The old village.
The old village. Yeah. And they got the rear deck off the car and I think one of the other panels, and we finished the race with the show car bodywork.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, it just was, we had nothing else. We'd gone through every piece of bodywork. And that's just, an amazing sort of story of this will to win, resourcefulness, trying to sort of think outside the box, thinking about, okay, what can we do to keep this car going because we can win this race. And it just shows you how great Corvette racing is.
Because I'm told the show car was a dummy chassis.
Yeah.
But obviously it was dressed.
Yes.
In bits of probably one spec old bodywork, I suspect.
Yeah, but we just needed something to slap on the car to get it over the line, you know. And yeah, it was, I do remember that year just being this, I think Doug Feehan came and I was standing there in the pit lane about to get in the car. And, you know, the car's maybe almost just coming into the pit lane and Feehan sort of grabs me, turns me around. He says, don't you screw this up. Do not go off again. And he gave me a serious talking to. And I was definitely put on the step, you know.
You're right.
Yeah, do not screw this up. So, you know, sometimes it takes a bit of that. And he sort of put me in my place and made sure that I understood the gravity of the situation.
I mean, Doug, I mean, really, we should talk a little bit more about him because he's been a constant throughout the program. And obviously, there's been Gary Pratt from Pratt & Miller and a few others have been constants. Mm. But, you know, I think Doug is just so important in the success of the program, but also the fact that it's still going.
Yeah, I mean, he has, at times, kept the program running, like you say, single-handedly, you know, keeping the people at the Rensen engaged and understanding of what we're trying to do here and keeping the Corvettes going back each year to Le Mans. He is really instrumental in it, and he has been just this huge figurehead of the program. And, you know, he is an unbelievable character and somebody with a million stories, and someone that you should get on something like this, because he could just sit here and talk and talk and talk and keep you guys entertained for hours. But he is a legend, let's say, of the race and of Corvette racing. And he was the person who got me my job there. Mm-hmm. You know, it was Ron Fellows who told me to go and have a chat with Doug Feehan.
Really?
Yeah. And I then picked up the phone and had a chat with Doug Feehan. And then I met Doug Feehan at Laguna Seca in 2001.
But he knew what you could do from the Conrad.
Yes.
From beating them at Sebring.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is also a good story.
Yeah, yeah. So you sort of join the dots up and you sort of go, okay, right, well, how I ended up getting there. And then you look at a lot of the other drivers and how they've ended up at Corvette Racing.
By beating Corvettes. Yes,
exactly.
Olivier Beretta.
Yep.
Antonio Garcia.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was beating us in the Ferrari.
Of course, he did a few races.
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
in the ALMS.
Yeah.
And then Tommy was beating us in the BMW.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you sort of look at all of that, you go, okay, well, that's one of his strategies was, okay, we need to take those guys away from those other manufacturers.
Yeah.
Because they're the guys that are making that thing work and beating us. And so, you know, when it worked with me and then obviously Olivier and then Jan. And so you can sort of see their strategy, and it's worked. You know, we've had all this success. But yeah, he's a remarkable man, and he's always got a story, and he's always got something going on. And, you know, his Corvette corrals that we have each weekend in the United States, he reels out a story, and you as you're being brought along to the corral, you know, there's, say, Watkins Glen, there's maybe 400 people in the tent, and you can hear him talking. You can hear all of them laughing to his stories, and there's always something that's from, well, Watkins Glen is always after Le Mans, and so there'll be some story from Le Mans that he's regaling them with, and it's, you know, it's, there's an element of truth in the story, you know, but he's always sort of like
a little embellishment.
Yeah,
along
just
the way.
You know, and he loves a bit of that.
But he's a great raconteur, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, he should have actually been on the stage.
Well, but then we would have missed him in motor racing, wouldn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, so, I suppose so.
To get a bit of a feel for how things have changed with the cars, obviously we're used to these yellow Corvettes, but they, I presume, even though kind of ostensibly they look similar from a distance, is there kind of a sort of family lineage through the cars? Do they all feel similar, or have there been big changes in that period in terms of how they are to drive?
Well, you know, that Pratt and Miller have been the people who have put the C5R together, the C6R, and then that was the sort of GTS and GT1 cars, and then of course we switched from GT1 into GT2 with the C6, and then we then moved to the C7R. And yes, they're all front engine. They've all got a very sort of definite sort of Pratt and Miller feel to them. But they have all developed and evolved, and the understandings of a lot of things, as with every race car, has moved on and developed, you know, whether it's with the aerodynamics of the car or the weight distribution of the car or the materials that they're using, or, you know, the homologation rules and all that sort of stuff. You know, it has moved on substantially. But I would say fundamentally, you know, the driving style that I had in the C5R is not too different to the driving style I've now got in the C7R. One of the biggest changes, though, when we went from Goodyear to Michelin, and that was probably our biggest overall performance gain of anything we've ever done, and that was pretty extraordinary.
Was that 04 or 05?
That was going into I think it was 04. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was 04, because it coincided with Olivier joining.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think Jan and Olivier did a couple of tests on the Goodyear they went, oh, this is not very good. And then we started testing on the Michelin, and it was sort of like, yep.
Of course, Olivier has very close links.
Yes, with, yeah, exactly. And Michelin, and he was still doing a lot of testing in Formula One for them at the time. And, you know, so he had a very close relationship with them. So I'm not sure whether any of that helped. I don't know whether there was any of that that helped.
Well, it was a big emotional decision for Chevrolet, because certainly at that point, certainly when the program started, Corvette made a big thing of saying every Corvette delivered new from the factory
had been, Green, Kentucky,
had been delivered on Goodyear tires. Yeah, so they, you had to race them.
Yeah, so the OEM deal was huge. And then, you know, once we went to that on the racing program, I think it was only a matter of time before the Michelin then appeared on the road car. And yeah, I mean, it's been a, for us and performance wise, it's been spectacular. It's been great. And, you know, that is the go-to tire for everyone now in our class.
One thing I wanted to ask about, you talked about the kind of different standards of drivers that you touched on that earlier. Often people talk about the, obviously the P1 drivers dealing with slower traffic, but you're kind of in the middle in that obviously all the GTE Pro drivers are high quality professional drivers. You know where you stand with them, but then you've got P2 cars that could have a proper platinum professional in it, could have a bronze, there's a few bronzes even in those cars. You've got the GTM cars that could have a strong driver in at that time or could have someone a bit more sketchy. How difficult is it to be in the kind of middle, should we say? Because obviously the GTE Pro guys, less than anyone can afford even to give away a second unnecessarily. I
mean, and that's that is another point to the race where you have to be really on your game in terms of how you're getting yourself past those slower drivers, or in the a relatively fast car, but it is a slower driver, you know it is, and you can sort of get the sense from the body language of the car and some of the places it's being put on the track and how it just how it's being driven. You get a good, you don't necessarily have to be told by the team who it is in the car. You can sort of almost recognize who it is if you've come across that car a couple of times. But it is all part of the, and parcel of the race and the nature of things there at Le Mans, and it can undo you. It really can. And you've by you being just a little bit over eager and less patient, let's say, to get by a guy like that, that can shape your race. And so, you know, we're being told all the time on the radio, you know, on trying to be smart and clean and keep a cool head, and but it's tough to do when you're there. You're a pack of four or five cars, and everybody is, you know, looking to pounce on any mistake, and you're hoping that this guy is going to trip the guy up in front of you so you can get by him. You know, and you know, any of the other guys that are behind you, you're hoping that guy is going to slow them up, you know. So you're trying to use the traffic as a bit of a pick at times to give you an advantage and try and slow your competitors down. But it is part of the skill of it, and understanding, you know, where you are on the track. And you sometimes do take a little bit more of a risk to get by someone, particularly if you know that you're going to be caught up behind. You know, Porsche curves is a classic example. You know, if you're following a slower car into there, you know you've got to take a pretty big risk to get by that car in those corners, which is not always advisable. So if you can get the pass done before you get into that section of track, then you know that you're likely to make an advantage over if there's someone close behind you, because they're going to get held up unless they've managed to hustle themselves by as well. But that's the risk that they could be taking, you know, getting contact and maybe getting a punch or breaking something or bodywork damage, you know. So it's all these decisions that you're trying to make on the fly and use your experience. And you can sometimes see, I think it was 2015, I was out in the night. And I think I was racing one of the Astons very, very hard. And we were battling either for the lead, or we were second or third or something like that. And I think the chap in the car was less experienced. I think it was Fernando Reis. I think he had done Le Mans a few times, but he had not done it a lot. Mm-hmm. And he was pressurizing himself. I could see he was pressurizing himself because he knew that he was battling for one of the top spots in the class. And it was a night, and you could see that as I was slowly applying the pressure more and more and more, he was getting more and more ragged. And then another car got in the mix, and that was it. And he went off and through the gravel, and that was pretty much the end of their effort.
I think he had an off after a brake change, actually, if I remember. Potentially on the out lap or his first flying lap after they had changed discs and pads.
He was. I think that I'd got past him before that point, and I'd sort of maybe I'm confusing the through the gravel bit with that but I know that I ended up hustling him and pushing him into an error, and getting by him. And I think that was at the first chicane as well. And there was another car involved, but it is. It's a nature. It's something that happens in the race, and it's something you've got to deal with. But when you look at the pro drivers in our class, and you can see the guys who are unbelievably fast, and they're taking some of the biggest risks, and you're thinking, this is going to pay off. Yeah, you're going to get you're going to get yourself up the road. But it's going to bite you at some point. And sometimes it doesn't. You know, they take those big risks and it just all works out for them. But then other times you'll then see the car off or damaged or puncture or in an incident, something hanging off of it. And I suppose that's just sometimes experience that you've built up over the years, and you can sort of kind of see a situation coming.
I've written a story about the simulator program that the ACO run. It's going to be in Autosport's Le Mans supplement in a week or so's time. And the ACO are very proud of that. And they do feel that the quality of driver and the way they prepare is much better now than it was back in the day. Would you agree that the sort of the standard is up?
I think it is. I think that they've worked at that, and they know that it was a number of years back, it was quite a problem. And it was causing some really horrendous accidents. You know, Mike Rockefeller is a very lucky lad. That was just
2011, I believe.
That was terrifying. That was, I came around the corner, or sort of coming down to Indianapolis, most probably 20 seconds after the crash had happened. And there was bodywork everywhere. There was marshals on the track, and there was very little flagging going on. And it just, the whole area was just in this sort of huge state with just bits and pieces of vehicle all over the racetrack, and chaos, real chaos, and smoke, and nobody really knowing what was happening. And fortunately, nobody else was sort of involved in the next sort of
the aftermath.
But yeah, I mean, I think that the standards have improved, and I think that things are heading in the right direction, but you can't ever take your foot off the throttle with this sort of stuff. And you've got to all the time be looking at ways you can improve. And I think that they understand that. And I think that they're doing, you know, working with the FIA, working with, you know, the level now of the driver's briefing and the way that we go through everything, you know, with the slow zones and those sorts of things, I think it has got better. But there's still stuff that they could do.
What's your view on the opening up of the Porsche curves, not of the actual racing line, but of the pushing the walls back, which has been an ongoing process, sort of culminating last year? Some people have been very critical. Other people have been very supportive. Where do you lie?
Yeah, I mean, there was always that sort of the first few years that I went there, it was that sort of moment of coming into the Porsche curves. You sort of would take a little bit of a deep breath and go, okay, now you're going to sort of be driving really fast through a very narrow part of racetrack in a car that's on very low downforce. and there's no margin for error. You know, you make a mistake and you're in the wall. And so you sort of did have to sort of, you know, build yourself up as you're coming up to the Porsche curbs. You sort of be, all right, let's get ready for this, you know. But you would develop a rhythm. You develop a flow. And for such a big track, it's funny how you can get that for Le Mans. You know, you get into a routine and a rhythm and a flow. And the Porsche curves is just another part of that. And so the wall being there or not being there, I'm still driving it the same way. I'm still driving it to the limit that I feel. And I feel in control of what I'm doing. It's I suppose, only when you go over the limit and then you end up on the grass or you end up, you know, out of control that you're going, actually, you know, I wouldn't mind a bit more room here. You know, yeah, if something goes wrong, yes, it would be nice if I could have that little bit more runoff area. But it does detract a little bit, you know, from it. But safety is a huge thing. And, you know, I think that they've done a lot of good things. They've done far more good things than they have.
And I'd absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
You know, and yes, there might be some people who are saying, "Oh, you know, I think it's taken away some of the character." There's a little bit of that, but not much. It's still the same corner, same corners.
Yeah.
You know,
my argument would be, and I have mixed emotions about it. My argument would be, is if the walls weren't moved back, at some point there'd be another big accident.
Yeah.
And then we'd lose that section. Chicane would go in, or it would just be, you know, changed beyond recognition. And,
it's a good point.
And no, and the character lost. You know, and that's, of course, that's a dilemma that motor racing circuits have been facing for 40 years, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. And you know, I think one of the things about Le Mans, when you go there each year, I think as drivers, you get this sort of real sort of sense of, okay, this place is really fast. This place, we're driving around here on low downforce, like it's the car feels and handles and moves like no other track that we go to, not even Daytona, you know, really. And you sort of get this real sort of sense. It has just that unique quality and that unique feel. And it takes, you almost have to have a bit of a switch of mindset about the place and understand that you're going to be operating and running at some really, really high speeds for a very, very long time. And just understand that and know that. And, you know, if something goes wrong, you know, it's likely that the accident's going to be quite a long one.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, with all the success you've had there, the five wins obviously have all come in a class battle, incredibly competitive. But is there any part of you that wishes you could have had a go at winning outright? Because clearly you have the ability to do that. But to have won Le Mans outright is obviously the thing everyone looks to.
Yeah, I mean, you do. You do look up there. You do look to, you know, the likes of Marcel and Mike and you know, realise that those guys have won it outright, which is really special for them. Yeah, you know, I think we all would look at that and go, yeah, that would be pretty special to do. But we also realise that we're driving for a brilliant team. We're racing in most probably the best class in the race, with some of the you know, actual great racing, you know, all the way throughout the race. And you know, I think that gives you a great sense of sort of satisfaction if you come away victorious. I think that we all as drivers would like to have taken that overall victory. That would be pretty special to do. But again, I'm lucky the fact that I've been able to do this race, you know, the 18 times, 19 coming up, and I've been doing it for a factory team. So I'm not going to stand here and go, it's not fair. I wish I'd had a chance to go, you know, for the outright, because I think I've been more than lucky enough.
The other thing is, imagine if that was the battle for the outright. If you could say you could have a Le Mans with, obviously, the 17 GT Pro cars, very strong lineups. Imagine you could have Ferrari, Corvette, BMW, Aston Martin, you know, these great marks all going hammer and tongs. That would be incredible, wouldn't it?
They would get my vote.
And the battle always is incredible, but there's always got that slight dampened on it because it's not for the outright. And just to think what that sort of race would be like would be absolutely sensational.
It certainly would be. I don't know whether it would add any more spice to it or not. But
not for those in it, I wouldn't have thought.
No, because everybody is pushing
as hard as
they
can. In terms of the wider perception of the race, you could say, look at what's going on. Because some of the GT Pro races the past years have been absolutely ridiculous, really, in terms of how close and competitive.
Think of the one that you weren't involved in because it was a Ford and Ferrari affair in 2016.
I mean,
wasn't that a great race? I mean, Ferrari might say Ford were playing with them, but, you know, Verlander and those guys were ragging it, weren't they? And it was a great race.
Yes, it was. I wasn't watching it that closely, but yes, I mean, there has been some fantastic races in our class, and you know, maybe that's something that the ACO and the FIA and those guys are still sitting there trying to. Well,
we know there's GTE Plus has been discussed. Who's pushing it the hardest? We don't really know. You know, there's talk about it happening as the premier class for 2020-2021.
Okay.
It's hard to say. You know, is it going to happen? Don't know. We're expecting more news during Le Mans week.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the prototype class has been so strong for so long. And I think P2 is really strong. You know, when you look at that, I think there's a huge amount of interest in that. And there's some great teams and some very professional and well-run outfits and some great drivers in it. And it is a multi-class race. And
do you think it should be? Because the funny thing is that when I first started following Le Mans properly in the 80s, you know, reading Autosport, the snippets that you could find on TV and radio, which were really just snippets, no GT cars. It was, there was a handful of Group B cars, which then disappeared in the late 90s. So it was basically Group C1 and then the smaller cars, Group C2, or it's initially called Group C Junior. So don't forget that GT cars only came back in 1993. And obviously their GT cars are part of the heritage of Le Mans. But it's funny how the sands shift, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think so much of this is obviously driven by the money, what manufacturers want, what's the direction that things are going, and the business model that's there in sort of in place. And I think that the World Endurance Championship and the way that operates, and then the way that Le Mans is, it has to stay a multi-class championship. And I can't see it moving away. I think both on the other side of the Atlantic in the United States, it's multi-class, it's three classes. And I think that WEC will stay four. I suppose there's a possibility it could go to three, but I think they're set and they want to keep it that way.
I think you're right. Probably in my time of going to Le Mans,
right?
We'll see a four-class, three-class, maybe a five-class setup. Yeah, I don't think
being much different, really. Mm-hmm. Not now, not at the moment.
Well, before we wrap up, let's just put you on the spot, Gary, because we do have a great of Le Mans here. Mm-hmm. How would you rate and evaluate what Oliver Gavin has done at Le Mans as a driver to have this long career, all this success, and still be there at the top? So many years.
Yeah, come on, Gary. How have I done?
Well, we know that people get annoyed with what you write sometimes. So
the boy's done good,
isn't
he? Not bad for a Formula First champion, I would say.
1991 Formula First champion. I still remember it. Yeah, all of those years ago.
Well, I mean, the most amazing thing is, okay, you've got five victories. You could have had more. How many? Three more podiums at Le Mans?
Yeah, three or four. I had a podium my very first one with Celine.
Of course,
yeah,
yes.
My very first race there. But I was pole position in the class in 2001.
Which, of course, was Celine. With Ray Malek.
No.
Was that Conrad as well?
That was Franz Conrad. But it was the Conrad's Speed Lab.
Ah, right, yeah.
So there was Steve Celine, Franz Conrad. That's another whole story with the way that was run and done. Uh-huh. But qualified the car on pole.
I mean, yeah, I mean, an amazing. I mean, there aren't too many drivers who've got as many class victories as yourself. But going back to what we were talking about before, so many years with one manufacturer. I've looked into it, and I can't. I think you're a record breaker, and that's you know, it's an amazing program, and you're part of it. In it has been, yeah. I mean, as you said earlier, you know, at the beginning, you pinch yourself sometimes. Yeah. And if I'd have told you, oh yeah, in 2019, you'll be celebrating your, you know, well, Corvette will be celebrating its 20th year, yeah, and you'll still be with them.
Yeah,
we'd have had a little laugh, wouldn't
yes,
we?
Yeah, I think I would have. But there's one thing that I was looking at the other day. And since 2003, I have started the race for the number 64 car, and I have started it every single year since then. I've always been the first guy in the car. I've never actually, so the only time I've ever been at Le Mans with Corvette and watched the start of the race from the pit box was the very first year that I did it.
How bizarre! Hey, really? Yeah.
So that's. I was trying to figure out whether that was a record or not.
Well, it could easily be.
Right. It's a bit of a weird stat, but yeah. You know. But it is amazing to take the start there. You've got to say it's one of those things where you see everybody's racing really hard, and you sort of think, okay, it's going to calm down. It will calm down in a minute. And then with our class, it just continues. And it just continues for the next 24 hours.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be another fantastic Le Mans, and the GTE Pro Battle will be fantastic. So all the best for you. Obviously, there's always a bit of luck at play at Le Mans, but it's going to be a fantastic battle. And thanks for sharing some of your experiences.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
And thanks also, Gary Watkins. Well, there'll be all sorts of news on autosport.com about the Le Mans 24 Hours. Autosport magazine, as Gary mentioned, always have our preview supplements where you can get your insight into all the runners and riders and some of the stories surrounding
out
the race.
Out on June the 6th, I believe.
June 6th, so it will be out when you listen to this podcast. Do check out sistertitlesmotorsport.com, F1 Racing Magazine out monthly, and Motorsport News out every Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
American Giant is the leading manufacturer of American-made clothing. When you choose American Giant, you are saying yes to clothes made under the highest standards, ones that support sustainable jobs, living wages, safe working conditions, and use high-quality materials. Plus, they have a full range of timeless, durable basics for men and women. Wear your values in the new year. Get 20% off with code NY23 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off at American-Giant.com. Code NY23.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.